Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
And good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. All right, here's where we're headed today. First of all, the phones are open to start the show. We're at 802-244-1777. Or 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Your choice of subjects. Also, Thursday is Veterans Day. So if there is a military veteran story that you would like to share, you can give us a call. We'd love to hear about them. I'll also relate my trip through the Middle Estate on Saturday. It took me to Rawsonville and Cuttingsville. If you want to share a place or an event in the state with our listeners, we'd love to hear about it. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. And then we have at 9:30 Greg Gouma. He'll join us. He's the author of a new book focused on Vermont's activists and social movements. Then Agency of Agriculture Secretary Anson Tebbets will share his experiences at WDEV and elsewhere as we continue celebrating 90 years of WDEV. We finish the show by speaking with Jenny Bryan, whose current exhibit at the Sullivan Museum and History Center on the campus of Norwich University is definitely worth a visit. I got to see it last week. But first, let's get the phones ringing, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. It is a special day. This is our one-year anniversary of Vermont Viewpoint. You know, some said it wouldn't happen. Some said it shouldn't happen, but I did it. I made it for to a year. And so I want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to be with you this long every morning, except, of course, those days I take off. But and thanks to everybody who fills in, Lee Cattell and Governor Jim Douglas, Pat McDonald, and others who have been here to take care of things when I'm out. Another thing in the news that you're hearing about is the Travis Scott concert in Houston. Eight people who were killed during that concert. And I've mentioned this before. In 1979, I was in Cincinnati at the Who concert, and it's interesting to flip back to that again. After the events of what happened in Houston, first of all, this was going to be the Who's final concert, tour, and of course they're still going. But you know, that's why we all had to be there, and it was at Cincinnati Riverfront Coliseum, and there was a crush of people to get in one door in each of the entrances, and most people came together in one area, which was closest to the parking garage. You came across a bridge, and that's where most of the people kind of accumulated, and they only opened one door. But things were happening before those doors opened up. The crush of people had people pushed hard against the side of the building. There was no presence of security or police out there, and it got similar to what you saw in Houston this past weekend. People just pushing and shoving, and people having difficulty breathing as they were smashed against the walls of this Coliseum. And you didn't believe that anything like that could possibly happen. And as we left the concert and turned on the radio in our car, we found out that that indeed did happen. So, you know, the lessons that were learned in 1979, apparently, you know, forgotten in 2021. And that's a sad state of things. All right, let's go to Randolph and start things off with Doug. Hi, Doug. What's up?
Good morning. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Got the party hat on today.
Good. One thing is this advertising blitz with the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just a little bit over the top?
And what are you referring exactly, Doug?
The Social Security thing that stacks up this time of year, and it's a
So I think it's probably, and again, I don't know yet exactly, you know, I don't have to do that yet, but I think you're probably referring to maybe if you're uninsured, you know, there's a time to sign up, or it could be a Medicare deadline, but these things tend to ramp up at a certain time of year because of you know, deadlines to join.
Well, it just seems over the top, but and some of the ads are so deceiving that they start right out with this red, white, and blue thing, like they're part of Social Security, and they're not.
Mm.
And most of the representatives have been hit in the head repeatedly. And the other thing is, the state is the first to recognize that we have a broadband problem.
Right.
Yeah, everything we hear is go to www.
Yeah. And you know, more so during the pandemic, Doug, your point is very well taken there that, you know, we are shifting more and more to a digital world, a digital economy, you know, a lot of things done digitally, like telemedicine, you know, with the pandemic and kids having to learn from home. There's the need for broadband. And so, yeah, we've been trying to get to that last mile, trying to get everybody online with high-speed internet in the state for a number of years. And you're absolutely right, especially if we're sending everyone to websites and we're shifting things for virtual presentations. Yeah, we need to definitely get on it now. I think this is the bell has rung, and there are efforts. We've talked about the CUDs, and we had one on last week, CVNet, you know, that you know, definitely would be helping that situation. So we need to get there. Let's go to Randolph Center now, and we've got Mary. Good morning, Mary.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Congratulations on 1 year.
Thank you.
Yes, it's really an enjoyable show, and I tell lots of people about it because you never know what you're going to learn. So it's great, and I enjoy listening to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
So your previous caller really hit a nerve, Doug. Mm-hmm. I've gotten every single day I get something in the mail about updating my Medicare insurance.
Interesting.
And it's from the state of Vermont. It's from AARP. I've got one on my table here. I had one yesterday I had to call. I had my husband's name on it. My husband's been deceased for 8 years.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, so it's very, very disturbing. And I thought, if they spent all of this money helping people stay well instead of sending us all this useless paperwork. But anyway, it just hit a nerve.
Well, good. And I'm glad Doug brought it up. He's probably experiencing exactly what you are. Now, is there a certain deadline at a certain time of year?
Yeah.
The reason it's ramping up, I'm not trying to justify, you know, everything that's being sent out. So what is the deadline for these things?
Yeah,
Mary?
So there's an annual enrollment, and it starts on, I think it's October, the middle of October, and it ends, well, this note says December 7th.
Oh.
So, yeah. But, you know, I'm very, very happy with what I have.
Right.
And, you know, that's it. Yeah. I'm not doing anything. And they are very deceiving because a lot of them say free.
Oh,
a lot of
interesting.
Them are free.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, these different plans, all free. You get all of this. And when you really look into it, we know there's nothing free. Right, Rick?
Well, yeah. It's when I went to business school, when I went to University of Dayton, I was in the College of Business. And the first thing they taught us was there's no free lunch. I was like, what does that mean? And it's everything has a cost in the end. And, you know, sometimes it's to you, sometimes it's to government through taxation, which is a cost to you. So you're right. Nothing's quite free. But that is interesting that, if only it was like an email, Mary, that you get and you can go down to the bottom and, you know, respond and say, take me off your list. Mail just isn't like that, unfortunately. So
no, it's not.
Do what I do. Take one look at it and right into the bin if it has no relevance. So
absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that call, Mary. Let's get right back to the phones, talking to Jim in Barrytown. Morning, Jim.
Hey, happy Veterans Week.
Yes, indeed. Happy
Veterans
Week.
My dad went off to the Okinawa conflict before I was born. And the day before he left was New Year's Day, and he married my mom.
Oh, my gosh.
So he shoves off for 4 years. So he gets there, and I don't know if they still do this in the military now. I was never a military guy. But they gave IQ tests. And they gave my dad an IQ test when he got to Okinawa. And he scored so high, they couldn't believe it. He was off the chart. So they gave him another test, and he scored even higher.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So.
Well, we knew he was smart for marrying your mom.
I kind of picked up on that when I was being raised.
Uh-huh.
But he was much smarter than I was. Yeah. And so they booted him up the ladder.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And so he was there for 4 years, married my mom on New Year's Day, came back 4 years later, and how they did it, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then I was born.
Wow.
And my dad went on to really respect country, the flag, and God. And I learned a whole lot from him. But the story about the IQ test was just...
That is really phenomenal. Did he stay in the military beyond the four-year stint then?
No, he became a housing contractor here in the Barrie area.
Oh, I love it.
And when he got back, started building houses, and then back in the 60s when the big housing boom was going on, he had a crew of like 30 guys. So he ended up building about 300 homes in the area.
Nice. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great story, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for the show.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Wow. If anyone knows if those kind of tests are still given, I'm sure there's personality tests that are given to members of the military. IQ tests, I'm not sure. But, yeah, it was a way of identifying, I guess, you know, who you had in your ranks who might be more of a leader, and Jim's father was that. But, wow, get married, shove off for 4 years, and then come back and start your married life. That's incredible, but really pretty lovely. Thanks to Jim's father for his service. Thanks to all veterans. We have a bunch in my family, and I'm so proud of each and every one of them. All right, time to go to the Duke of Newbury. It's Fred's turn. Hey, Fred, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good. Hey, you know, that last caller, he's right. What the Army does today is they give you what they call is a general aptitude technical test.
Uh-huh.
And it's called the GT test for short. Now, the GT test is made up of reading, comprehension, sentence, understanding, and arithmetic. And the average is between 90 and 100. And in order to go to OCS or to qualify for going to officer training, you have to have 110 on that GT, and then flight school is the same thing as 110, and so that's the name of the game in the Army way back when I was in the Army.
Yep.
You had to score well on this general aptitude test, and I don't know what the maximum is, but I do know that a couple of guys that were in my unit had had high ones, and they were running between 128 and 135.
Wow.
And those were considered really high. But anyways, the name of the game today is to get a GT score of 110 or better, and you can almost qualify for anything in the Army.
Interesting. Well, Fred, thanks for clearing that up. And so a type of IQ test still definitely administered in the military, the GT test. And
I don't know if it's an IQ test. I don't know if it's an IQ
test. It's more of a general aptitude test.
It's a general aptitude or general technical test. And my guess is you probably would have a relatively high IQ for that, but I really don't know because there's – To the best of my research, there's no correlation between that GT test and your IQ, but there probably is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the military or the Army that takes a lot of thinking to be able to pass the courses.
Yeah. All right. Just a quick search that I did, Fred. It looks like 110 is kind of what you want to hit. That is kind of the gold standard. So you're right about that as well.
Yeah, that's the gold standard. All right.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. All right.
Okay.
All right. And we move on to Duxbury next, where Pam is joining us. Hi, Pam.
Hey, I'll be quick because I know we're coming up on the bottom of the hour. But
all right.
I missed your coincidence show because I didn't have any, but yesterday I did.
Oh, excellent.
I had some old photos of my mom and grandfather from St. Stephen, New Brunswick. They were all great athletes. Mm. My mom is actually in the New Brunswick Sports Hall of Fame. I sent some pictures to them. Mm-hmm. she was born in 1916. But then I contacted the high school where my mom went to high school and also taught for a while. And I heard back from the principal, and I was reminiscing about what I remembered in my grandparents' street and the penny candy store. Mm-hmm. And we kept talking. Well, it turns out her grandfather was the son of my granddad's brother, and so somehow or other we're cousins.
Oh my goodness.
And we just kept exploring, and we dug, and there's still some relatives who have that wonderful history, and they're like, oh yeah, uncle Art and Aunt Bess, and yeah, well, I remember the Lowe's, they lived on Church Street. And it's just like, wow. So, small world.
Oh, it is a small world. What was your mom's event? Why was she? What did she do to get into the New Brunswick Hall of Fame?
She played both basketball, which was full court back then.
Wow.
In Canada, anyway. She was a defensewoman and was the leading scorer in the whole province. And the same thing in ice hockey. She was a defense person, and they skated outside with skirts over their long pants, and she was the leading scorer in New Brunswick.
Oh, my goodness.
I did not get those jeans.
Oh, did she? Is that what you have pictures of her playing back in the day?
I have the pictures of the pose team afterwards, uh-huh. and one of the championship teams where she was captain. So this was like 1932.
Oh, my.
And my grandfather's baseball team in New Brunswick, and he's also a great hockey player. Mm. So, it's like, what do I do with these? The kids don't want them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be here much longer. And I found these marvelous homes for them in these historical locations back in their province.
Oh, well done,
Pam. It just makes me so happy.
Oh, that is such a great story.
I found a cousin.
You did. You got a cousin in the deal. A lovely home for cherished memories that will be seen forevermore. And you found a cousin. So, that's such a great story. Yeah, across the border, too. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, Pam, thanks for calling us this morning.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, isn't that a great story? Oh, I'm verklempt here. That is really neat. I didn't get to tell my story about heading down to Cuttingsville and Rawsonville this weekend, but I don't care. We had wonderful calls this morning. It was really great to talk to you all. I do want to let you know that tomorrow morning I will be broadcasting live from the Radio Vermont Job Fair. That's going to be at the Capitol Plaza in Montpelier. And that goes on from 7 to 1. Steve Cormier will be doing call-ins with some of the companies that are there who are hiring from 7 to 9. And then I'll be there from 9 to 11 talking to these companies, and he'll be back on from noon to 1. But if you are looking for a job, I think there's at least 20 different companies there, and they are hiring. So this is a great time to get yourself to Montpelier. And there's a great list of the companies at our website, wdevradio.com. Check that out. And come join us tomorrow, 7 to 1, so you have a lot of time. If you already have a job and are looking for a change, you can, you know, stop in before you get to work or come over on a break. We'd love to see you there. All right, that'll do it for Open Phones. Again, thanks to all who called this morning. We're going to take a break, then we'll return to learn about Vermont activists and social movements of the past. And as a reminder, we've got Governor Scott's COVID-19 Response News Conference. That's coming up today at noon. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. There have been so many very interesting Vermonters over the last 200-plus years, always thinking ahead of the curve. Maybe it's something in the water that's generated this forward thinking. It could be like-minded progressive thinking has always been part of the DNA of those living through these incredibly long winters. Well, author Greg Gumma decided it was time to collect some of the Vermont activists and social movements in one place so their stories could be preserved forever. They're captured in Restless Spirits and Popular Movements. It's published by White River Press and the Center for Research on Vermont. And Greg Gumma joins us now to discuss the book. Greg, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Greg about his book or the activists and movements that he writes about, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Greg, when did you get to Vermont, and what were you originally doing here?
Well, I came here over 50 years ago in 1968, right out of college. I went to Syracuse University. I'm originally from New York, in Queens and Manhattan. And I came up here, my first jobs, I actually taught briefly. I worked with a film company that we thought we were going to sort of revolutionize the film industry. And eventually I settled into writing for a daily newspaper, the Bennington Banner. And that was my initiation at the age of 21, 22. And I went on from there to Bennington College to some government work for a number of years, all in southern Vermont for the first 5 years or so, and eventually came up to the Champlain Valley for graduate school and other jobs, and got involved in the progressive movement up in Burlington, in the late 70s and 80s. And the story goes on from there.
Yeah. What was Vermont like when you arrived, and when did things kind of start to shift politically and socially?
Well, I think it was in the process of shifting when I did arrive, the late 60s. You could say it was a part of a second wave of modern immigration. There had been some in the 50s, ex-urban professionals, people we know, names we know, Phil Hoff, Richard Snelling, both of whom I profile in the book. Were from other places and came up here and made their mark. I came a generation later in the late 60s with a more countercultural movement, and the impact began to be felt in the subsequent years. If you had to point to a tipping point, it is somewhere between the 70s and the 80s, and Bernie Sanders emerged locally at around the that time. There are many forces at work, but I would say culturally and politically, that's a pivot point. Before 1988, no Democratic presidential candidate ever won Vermont, including Franklin Delano Roosevelt. After 1988, no Republican candidate has won Vermont.
Well, and there's another stretch. There was, I think it was 100 straight years of Republican governors, Republican senators, right? But what was the politics like, you know, during that time? Because it definitely dominated by Republican candidates. But didn't we have, I'm going to say, a little bit more of a progressive Republican bent through that time here in Vermont?
Well, yes, because Republicans were in control of the state for so long, it was in a sense, you could say, a Big Ten party. There were different factions in the party. There was, you might call, the establishment wing, often identified with the marble interests, the Proctor family, the railroads, and so forth. But there was also a progressive wing. Sometimes it worked in combination with Democrats or other political parties to challenge at the local level, sometimes at the state level. I write about one of those challenges, a fusion movement in the early 20th century between Percival Clement, who was a railroad owner in Rutland, and James Burke, who was an Irish Catholic blacksmith and mayor in Burlington. And they tried to sort of challenge the established Republican interest. They failed. So you had this progressive wing, which by the 1930s and 40s really began to emerge more strongly. And Ernest Gibson and George Aiken famously represented this the other Republican, a part of the Republican Party, which had a great influence in the 20th century. I also write about a Vermonter named, many have forgotten, Ralph Flanders, who was a senator from Vermont, who really was one of the first people in the Republican Party who challenged Joseph McCarthy. I mean, publicly challenged him in hearings, brought charges against him. Really, it was Flanders as a leader of the attempt to really finally take down McCarthy after the Army-McCarthy hearings. That's another chapter in the book. And so, in some sense, in the book, I'm kind of retelling stories that have faded from history in some cases for a variety of reasons. Some we know, I'm reinterpreting some, but there's a bit of unearthing going on here too in what I'm writing, some of the areas of research or areas that have been given short shrift in past histories of Vermont.
Well, they will fade no more nor get short shrift any longer. One that you do write about, you mentioned him a little earlier, was Phil Hoff, became governor in 1962. Explain that significance and how that happened.
Sure. Phil Hoff came here in the 50s and became a state legislator. And at this point, you have to understand the apportionment of power in the legislature was quite different than it is today. It was not one man, one vote. It was one town, one vote. So if you lived in Burlington, you had one representative in the state legislature, and you lived in Canton, you had one, same amount of power. So which obviously tilted the political spectrum a bit. And so Hoff emerged as a political figure in association with liberal Republicans to challenge the Republican Party, became governor in 1962. There was a kind of a breakaway movement, a quasi-third party movement, the Vermont Independent Party, it was called. Later, a law was passed to prevent you from using the word independent in association with any other name. If you're an independent, you're an independent today.
Gotcha.
If you're, if you're something else. So they used a kind of a various devices. There were some lawsuits for reapportionment, one man, one vote. And that occurred while Hoff was governor in 1965. During the time when, in a sense, there was an expansion of state government, but also a shift in power. I mean, Democrats before that were vastly underrepresented, as you can imagine, because they were primarily from the urban areas of the state. So that happened all in the 60s, and Hoff rode that wave. He was sometimes talked about as a candidate for president. He was a supporter of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, made a lot of significant changes in state government. But he was building on a foundation that had been built over many generations by Republicans as well. And, and a lot of what people cherish about Vermont was, in a sense, created during that earlier period by Republicans who mixed both conservative and to some extent libertarian and civil libertarian and more equalitarian qualities in them. And those are all things I explore in the book.
Well, another person you've brought up, and I'd love to hear a little bit about his story, is Richard Snelling.
Yeah, well, you know, Richard Snelling was another person who came from Pennsylvania.
My area.
He was a very inventive guy, very creative guy. I knew him a bit. I interviewed him. Parts of the book that there's some quotes in the book and some insights in the book that rest on interviews and contacts we had over the years. He built his economic career first, but he was always active politically with developing industry and also changes in state government. Eventually, because the Democratic Party split in the 1970s and Phil Hoff was no longer on the scene, I mean, I think Snelling might have been governor earlier had it not been for Phil Hoff, eventually became governor in 76 when the Democratic Party was really kind of divided, and I would say ran a very solid, in many ways, of liberal administration, but he was very strict on communication and obviously finances. He was not, you know, pro-union, you might imagine. But he was sort of another one of these Republicans who isn't afraid to break with the conventional wisdom when it is necessary. He's often strategically broke, as I've noticed. Many of the people who have been Republican governors of Vermont, you know, make a point of saying, you know, I'm with the National Republican Party, but only to a point. And in some cases, some of the more memorable Republicans are people who have either sort of challenged it or left, in some cases, like Jim Jeffords.
Yeah, indeed. All right, we're spending time with author Greg Gumma. His latest book is called Restless Spirits and Popular Movements. Listeners, to join the conversation, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
If you owe the IRS back taxes, then get ready to pay up. The IRS has giant private collection agencies actively tracking down folks who owe the IRS. So if you think dodging them was stressful in the past, it's going to get a whole lot tougher. Optima Tax Relief has this advice. Don't wait. Solve your tax problems now before it's too late. Optima Tax Relief works to stop the demand letters, stop the aggressive collection actions, and stop the IRS collectors from targeting you. Ask Optima about the Fresh Start Initiative, one of the biggest breaks the IRS has ever offered. If you qualify, you could save thousands, and nobody knows this program better than they do. Optima is A-plus rated with the Better Business Bureau, and they get results, having resolved over $1 billion of tax debt for their clients. Get a fresh start. Call today for your free consultation.
Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
Hi, it's Tara from Green Mountain Solar. Winter is just around the corner, and most of us are dreaming of hitting the slopes, making snowmen, or, if you're like me, hibernating with a good book. But what no one is looking forward to, winter expenses. That's where solar's a smart solution. With heating costs on the rise, you can rest assured that with solar, your electric bill won't go up too. Solar will insulate you from rate hikes, offset your energy usage, and save you money. We also install heat pumps, which means you can slash both your electric bill and your heating bill. Or learn more about battery backup systems that can keep your lights on, no matter what storm Old Man Winter throws at Vermont. Have questions about solar? Like, how does net metering work? What incentives are available? What about snow? Our solar advisors will answer all of it. Ask us anything. And yes, we install year-round, even in winter. To get started with solar, visit us at greenmtnsolar.com.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, WDEV celebrates its 90th year by taking you back to February of 1980 with Banjo Dan and the Midnight Plowboys and Nancy Bevin.
I know what it means to be lonesome, and I know what it means to be blue.
Join us for a Vintage Vermont Live with Banjo Dan and the Midnight Plowboys and Nancy Bevan Wednesday night at 7 on WDEV AM and FM and streaming at WDEVradio.com.
Coming up today at 5:30 on the Brady Farkas Show, we got a lot of news and notes on the Red Sox offseason. We talked yesterday about J.D. Martinez coming back. What about Martin Perez and Garrett Richards going away? Did either of those moves surprise us? Christian Vasquez is also back in the fold. We take a look at that. And Major League Baseball trade rumors as their top 50 free agents with all projections of where they're going out. Just how many names they see coming to the Red Sox. Brady Farkas Show beginning today at 5:30 right here on WDEV AM and FM.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Restless Spirits and Popular Movements is Greg Gumma's new book. In it, he revisits Vermont history through memorable events and people who helped create its delicate balance of sovereignty and solidarity, political independence, and mutual aid. And Greg is with me until 10 o'clock to discuss his book. Listeners, you can call in with your questions or comments for Greg at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Greg, we should mention the book originally was published digitally. So what will people find in the new print version published by White River Press and the Center for Research on Vermont that they wouldn't find in the original version?
Well, there's a lot more text. There's at least, say, 20 to 25% more text, but there's also more than 100 illustrations, and I'm very excited about that because many of these are rare. A couple of dozen are photographs that I've taken over the past 50 years in Vermont, including the cover photograph, sort of mini photo essays, but also rare images. Some that in some cases that were censored or have rarely been seen, as well as an expanded narrative and also that text that was published digitally in 2017 was really sort of only dated until, say, 2011. And so I brought it up to 2020. So there's plenty of new information and it's never really been completely assembled like this. This is a what I call a transmedia project. A project that I've pursued over 10 years. Various essays have been published online and in print. There's a couple of short films. There's a segment of a longer documentary called The Vermont Movie, a six-part documentary, which contains a segment, which is also a chapter in this book. So I've been working on this from the standpoint of various media platforms and various stories and threads for a very long time, really over 40 years since I first published with friends a monograph, you might call it, like a magazine-style history of Vermont called Vermont's Untold History, similar in some ways to Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Yeah.
And this book has qualities of that. It's telling stories about the women's movement, the labor movement, indigenous people. It's telling a variety of stories about a variety of groups of people, collective, as I call it, collective outbursts, and individuals as well. And that's where it kind of differs perhaps from Howard Zinn, that I also focus on some of the individual stories and the influence of people who have either been born here and moved elsewhere, and his influence has been beyond the state. I talk about the Vermonters who have become president, who are born here, but they made their name in other places, people like Chester Arthur and Calvin Coolidge, but also people who have stayed as well, like, as I described, Ralph Flanders in the 50s and McCarthy era, Phil Hoff, Madeline Kuhn, and Bernie Sanders in the modern era. Some of these people I knew. I've been a reporter for over 50 years, and so a lot of it is based on interviews, personal experiences, observations in the latter half of the book. Covering the last 50 years. And the earlier part revisits stories that some people may be familiar with, but looks at it through a different lens.
Excellent. Let's get a call, and we got Jim joining us from Barrie. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I've been trying to track down an article for 35 years, and I thought maybe you might know of it or
this might be
know where it was or heard of it anyway. It was when I first moved to Vermont in 86, someone gave me a copy of it. And it was called Who Moved the Middle of the Road, or at least that line was used in there. And it was a story, and if I'm not mistaken, it was in Playboy magazine.
But it was an article about this fictitious state that you would move to because the politics were very small, local politics, and you could it had an entire plot or entire plan of how to move into this state and get involved in your local politics and ultimately not take over the state, but take over the political movement of the state. Does that ring a bell at all to you? It was Vermont that they were talking about.
Jim, let's leave with Greg now.
In a manner of speaking, you know, whether this is in fact a true or apocryphal, I'm not sure. But the story that I know of, and I kind of remember seeing this, and perhaps it was an Esquire in the late 60s, early 70s, the idea somebody was proposing that because Vermont was a small state in population, that if all of the people, progressive people, I don't know if they described it that way, they may have described it as countercultural or even described it as old, if all the hippies moved to Vermont, we could totally change the state. And I recall as a young person, you know, sort of hearing that almost as a sort of a general myth, or I don't know, maybe probably some form of wish fulfillment. I mean, demographically, as I said earlier, there were two waves of in-migration, and Vermont has had a history of having, you know, fairly dramatic both in-migration and out-migration, losing its young people, people still complain about. That's not a new complaint.
Right.
People have been having that complaint about Vermont for 150 years.
You are correct.
So it's a nice place to grow up and a nice place to move away from, as Stephen Douglas put it.
Also a nice place to move back to. So, all right. So
that's my feeling. Yeah, I always come back.
Yep. All right, Jim. So check for Esquire, maybe late 60s, early 70s for that article. And Greg, I do, before you go, because we only have a few more minutes, I want to talk about a person who's kind of Jim described, who moved here from away, got involved with local politics, and really made a difference, and that's Bernie Sanders, someone you've written a book about. I'm guessing that you would have had a front row seat to his earliest unsuccessful forays into politics. Did you have any idea then that he might eventually rise to statewide and national prominence?
I have to say, actually, yes, although, and this has been printed elsewhere, our first meeting was not a pleasant one. We met in late 1971. He was running for office already. He had been here 2 to 3 years. He was running for the U.S. Senate in a special election. I was a government worker counseling, unemployed adults and youth. And he was, campaigning on very much the same issues that he runs on today, with very much the same rhetoric.
Yep.
And we got in an argument over, were Vermont issues are important? Did it matter who he was versus the movement? It didn't end well that night, but we eventually reached an accommodation and worked in alliance for a number of years in Burlington. I almost ran for mayor at the same time he ran for mayor, but withdrew after talking with him and was on the slate with as a city council candidate in the election that he won, and Terry Barishas won for the city council. So I was, in a sense, in the movement as well as in the media during that period, and got to know him. I know his strengths. He's the most extraordinary politician I think I've ever met, and I've met a lot of politicians in many respects. He's built for what he does. That was apparent from the very beginning. And in terms of him running for the presidency, I wouldn't say I thought he'd run for the presidency, although I thought he could in the 70s. But by the 90s, certainly, I was asking him about this more than 20 years ago. And I think, frankly, that the reason that he didn't do it earlier is primarily because he was in Congress and not the U.S. Senate. Because in order to run for president out of Congress, he would have had to have given up his congressional seat, and he didn't want to do that. And so he waited until he was in the Senate and was in a position that he could run and not have to surrender his seat in Congress.
Boy, and your point about his same issues, same rhetoric, you know, back in the early days until today, that it remains the same, very consistent. He'll never be accused of being a flip-flopper. Greg Gumma is the author of Restless Spirits and Popular Movements. It's published by White River Press and the Center for Research on Vermont. And you can find more about the book at vermontresearchbooks.org. Greg, it's been a pleasure hearing about these great individuals and movements in Vermont's past, and congratulations on getting the book published.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
And it's available everywhere. I look forward to people loving Vermont the way I have come to.
All right. Thanks, Greg. We're going to take a break for the news, then we'll be back to chat with one of the WDEV 90th Anniversary All-Stars, Anson Tebbets. And today at 1 o'clock, it's equal time with Travin. Then we've got 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's time to learn more about another of the WDEV All-Stars from our 90-year history. And by way of introduction, I'd like to read a little bit from a profile on our next guest that was written by Vermont Business Magazine's Joyce Marcel a couple of years ago. Joyce wrote, "If you were going to design the perfect Secretary of Agriculture for a rural state like Vermont, you might look for someone with deep roots in the state, maybe going back to the 1860s. You might look for a person who has actually milked cows for a living. You would also want someone with good communication skills. You would then look no further than Anson Tebbets, as two governors have done." Well said, Joyce. And joining me now is the Ag Secretary and host of WDEV's For the Birds and former WDEV News Director, Anson Tebbets. Anson, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Anson a question, and yeah, it can be bird-related. You can call us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You grew up on that dairy farm in Cabot. How much did you listen to WDEV growing up?
Well, every morning, the radio was always on. It was always on in the barn while milking cows, and I think that's what really started me with the imagination of radio. It was always on in the house, and so it's always been a big part of, you know, big part of my life.
Did you have any favorites that you listened to while growing up?
Well, you know, first beginning, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning with Once Around the Clock. Mm. One of the gentlemen I was really fortunate to work with was the late Mike Carey.
Oh, wow.
Mike was, you know, on at that time. I had Brian Harwood, of course, Ken, Hester Fuller, Jeff Nicholson, Brian Joyce, Kaya, Joel, Jack, many of them that are still there. And it's just, I've had a wonderful, you know, wonderful folks I've been able to learn from and train from.
So what got your WDEV career started, Anson?
Well, it was actually, I went to school in Boston. I went to a school called Emerson College, which actually is very close to Fenway Park. I was a big baseball fan, so I listened to a lot of Red Sox games. And I listened to a lot of the talk shows, much like you're doing now. Back in the day, they were, most of those talk shows back in the late 70s, early 80s were in the cities. They're just, you know, talk radio was just coming into form, but mostly overnight. So I'd listen to talk shows overnight into Boston, and that sort of got me started thinking about, you know, the Red Sox and radio and where I might be able to go to school, what could be a little closer to the Boston Red Sox.
Mm, nice. So how does one make the jump from WDEV into the head of the Agency of Agriculture that first time?
Well, it began of, I think my knowledge of the state helps. You know, I spent a long time at WDEV. I spent like 7 years in the news department at WDEV. From there, I went to WCAX, and I was down in Rutland for about a year. And then I came back to Montpelier, so I was able to work here on the farm in Cabot and also do my work at the station at WCX out of the Montpelier Bureau. Mm-hmm. So I learned the I learned state government. I learned the state house. You know, I learned how bills became law. I learned about relationships. So that continued on. And then Governor Douglas asked me to be his deputy secretary of agriculture. And at that point, I was looking at I had some divisions that I was managing. One of them was economic development, marketing, et cetera, but also animal health, meat inspection, all those kind of things that are sort of the regulatory aspect. So that helped me get a good eye on how state government is run through the deputy's position with Governor Douglas back in the day.
And how did For the Birds get started? And you've been doing that, what, about 27, 28 years?
27 years, and wow. I have to say, I think it began, I was filling in, I think Brian Harwood was on the air at the time with me, and I was filling in the morning shift, and it was mid-winter, and we had a phone call. Someone was curious about, they'd seen a red bird, and they didn't quite know what that red bird was. So at that time, we just started to open up the phone lines for discussion. So the phones just went wild. I mean, people were calling in with theories and guesses. And I thought we may have had, you know, 20, 25 calls within a very short period of time. And of course, that's a lot. When you get that many calls in a very short period of time in radio, you're blessed. So from that, like, oh, man, that we should do a bird show. And at that time, Brian Pfeiffer, who was a reporter with the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, was working out of Montpelier, and he was a serious birder. I mean, he was Brian is you know, well versed and does it now as a career, does bird tours, a real naturalist. So I took my 4-H birding knowledge and combined it with his real expertise, and we got together and decided we went down to Ken's office as. Many of us have done, and you propose something with it, and Ken says, "Okay, let's do it." And off to the races we went, and now Chip is my co-host, but we've been doing it about 27 years.
Oh, that is outstanding! All right, so you shifted then to TV from radio, working at WCAX as you mentioned. What kind of transition was that for you to go from one medium to another that are quite different?
Yeah, it took me about 2 years to figure out I probably should comb my hair. TV is you know, it's coming from radio. You know, you're going to worry about pronunciation and you're not really worried about, you know, a lot of different things. But when you transition to TV, you're writing to video, and you don't have to say as much. You know, people are watching it, so. It was a good transition, but it was a little bit different. You know, I was blessed to have a number of wonderful photographers, that were paired with me that had experience. So I'm out, you know, gathering information, trying to get convincing people to talk to me. And I had the photographers who, of course, they're just, you know, some of the best in the country at WCAX. Who took care of the video and all the wonderful images and the editing and so forth. So my first year I went to Rutland, and down in Rutland at the time, they just reopened the Rutland Bureau, and I did shoot my own material. I had my own camera for the first year, and that was a whole new experience, learning how to successfully shoot video and audio and getting the audio correct and all the lighting. So that was, but it was wonderful training. It really helped me, you know, write better. There was no one to blame if I didn't get something on camera because I was the one doing it.
Right.
And then after that, I came back to Montpelier, and then I had a photographer with me for the next 14 years or so.
I won't ask you to pick a favorite between TV and radio, but what were the things that you enjoyed about doing radio? What were the things that you enjoyed about doing TV?
Well, radio, of course, can be very spontaneous, And, you know, with the internet, it's changed a little bit. Now it's everything is immediate with social media. But, you know, with radio, you can drop and go and you can interview someone. You know, the Montpelier flood was a big moment for WDEV, the one in the 90s that was in Montpelier. At that point, there was just a new cell phone company that had just opened up in City Center. And believe it or not, they gave me a cell phone during the Montpelier flood. And I was able to travel around Montpelier, you know, navigate all the water and do live reports with that cell phone. In fact, I think I got one before Governor Dean did. Governor Dean came in a little bit after that and got a cell phone. I remember that. But, then, you know, back in that day, they were big, big, big cell phones.
Yeah, they were like a brick.
Like a brick, and then you turned them on and made a big sound. And, but that – It was, you know, radio is much more spontaneous. You can go live. There's more imagination. But TV is similar in some aspects. The audio, people think about the visual part about TV, but audio is very, very important for television. If you can't hear it, you can't understand it. You don't have that natural moment. So that was very, very helpful transitioning from radio to TV. And of course, images are very powerful though. They're very, you know, it's a different thing, but sound can be very powerful as well. So both are compatible, just different mediums, and you just learn to adjust, in both of them.
When Governor Phil Scott asked you to come back into state government at the Agency of Agriculture, what were your thoughts? Were you excited to get back into that role?
Absolutely. You know, I've always, you know, been close to agriculture. You know, I grew up on a dairy farm. We had sugaring, we had sheep, we had horses here in Cabot. So it's always been part of my life. I've always reported on agriculture in my career. So I knew a lot of people that were in the business. Of course, it had changed quite a bit since even that short period of time that, you know, that nine years that I was between deputy and becoming secretary, but and it's a great time to be. It's a really wonderful time to be in agriculture. There's so much going on, so many needs, but Vermont is, you know, blessed to have great food, great people who love the land and the water, and trying to make a wonderful product. So it's a great place to be.
What would you say has been your greatest accomplishment as secretary so far?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we're trying to, you know, one thing I think it's important that we've raised the visibility of agriculture in Vermont, which is very important. And I stress that to our farmers all the time. They've got a lot of things going on in their lives. They're taking care of their animals, their land, their families, their neighbors. But they also have to pay attention to their consumers and understand where the consumer is to make sure they're in tune with it, where they are. So we've tried to elevate the agriculture as a business, more than just a way of life in Vermont. So I think we've accomplished some of that. And, you know, there's a lot more to do, and the pandemic has exposed quite a bit of things over the last year or so that we're trying to figure out a path forward. And I think we can make some progress on some of those issues, particularly with infrastructure, new markets. A lot of things changed overnight with the way people are doing business in Vermont, particularly with value-added products.
Do you ever get the urge to report a breaking agriculture news story, scooping the rest of the media?
I am so busy, I don't think about it as much. And I don't know, I mean, I give it to a lot of our reporters now because they're asked to do much more than I was asked to do, really, because with social media, you know, there's the resources are not there as much, I don't think, in a lot of places. So they're asked to get the story, write the story, shoot the story, and then they have to market their story as well through various platforms. But there's some advantages of it. You know, you can break a story with an iPhone, and you can tell a pretty good story with an iPhone now, even on television. So there's give and take, and particularly during the pandemic, I really felt for a lot of our reporters because you know, they were having to scramble to do things, and they weren't able to see as many people because that's where you really get the good story if you're able to have a relationship with someone and really, you know, speak to them, look them in the eyes, ask them a question or two. And I felt for them they weren't able to do that. They had to go online. plus they had to keep the health and safety of their, themselves and their family, and they couldn't go into their studios as much as well.
On the Ag Beat, you grew up on a dairy farm, Anson. You've seen the number of dairy farms in our state nosedive. What do you see as the future of dairy in Vermont?
Well, there is a future for dairy in Vermont. Of course, it's going to change. It's going to adapt. A lot of pressure on farmers right now. Of course, dairy farmers are trapped in a federal system, a federal pricing system that's antiquated, old. But there are many things that Vermont can say, hey, look, we can do this better than other parts of the United States. A is the quality. Our farmers produce some of the finest milk in the Northeast and in the United States, and that speaks to wonderful products that come from that. We have some incredible national brands, Cabot Cheese, Ben & Jerry's, Vermont Creamery, all those, and we've got artisan cheesemakers, and all that speaks to the quality of the milk that they produce. So there's value in that. I think we need to, tell that story more, maybe define our brand more, not only with dairy, but other agriculture. We're blessed to have big regions around us that know of Vermont, love Vermont, and know what we're about. But we need to work on, getting those products to those markets more efficiently through the food system. So there is a future in dairy. It's just going to change and adapt. And we're going to continue to work on that and be their champions if we can.
Let's go to the phones. We're going to head to New York State and talk to Eric. Hi, Eric. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you today, guys?
Good.
Hi, Eric.
Hey. So I just wanted to chime in very quickly because I'm a firm believer of words of encouragement. And Mr. Tebbets, I had met you, probably 5 years ago at the VABs. And having grown up watching you on Channel 3, as many people have been invited to, the whole Channel 3 news team into their homes, it was really nice to meet you and to find out that you are just an absolutely incredibly gracious human being. Now, though I'm born and raised in New York, my family's roots are in Addison County, Vermont. My grandfather, a dairy farmer for his entire professional career, working most recently at the Du Bois Farm in Addison. And I just wanted to call and say that it's wonderful to have somebody such as yourself at the helm, who is not just somebody there to, collect a paycheck and sort of lend the appearance that they're doing their job, but for somebody who is a fierce supporter of Vermont agriculture. I just wanted to call and voice my appreciation for what you do.
Eric, thanks for that call. Anson, you really do. I mean, they're two different worlds, being in communications, being the head of the Agency of Agriculture, and to do both so well. But, what do you draw from? I know those years milking cows, give you a good perspective, but you really still have to know, this state inch by inch, farm by farm, not just dairy, everything else that's going on. How do you stay on top? How do you prep, first of all, to be the head of the agency? And then how do you stay on top of everything that's going on at the different types of farms throughout the state?
Well, first of all, thank you, Eric, for your kind thoughts. And I think it begins with, agriculture. My parents, I got up early, I worked. You try to be fair, you do a good day's work. And I think, and in journalism, you must be fair. And that is part of growing up. Everyone has a story. I approach journalism in a similar way. That's like, we probably don't know everything that's going on in someone's life at that particular moment. So you have to pause. We cover a lot of tragedies. We cover a lot of conflict when you're in journalism. But in the back of my mind, I was always trying to be fair because, sometimes you just don't know everything that you when you produce that story. But as long as you're fair, usually people are pretty receptive to that. And I approach that, my job at the agency, the same way. I'm blessed with an incredible staff, really smart people who know how to get things done, and they know how to do it efficiently, on time, and try to do the best they can to serve the people of Vermont. And that's what we do. I mean, we work for the taxpayers of the state of Vermont, and every day we're about customer service. We try to do our best to return phone calls in a timely manner, emails, respond. And so we sort of approach it that way. But I think in the end of the day, it's probably just my roots of, you know, getting up every morning, doing the chores, going to school, getting the work done, and treating people fairly. And if we do that, I think we're doing okay.
And in the interest of being fair, when you've been on the media side, you haven't been particularly hard on ag secretaries compared to, like, other people in the government.
I don't know. I guess, you know, I gosh knows what people are saying about you when you're not in the room, though. I mean, I don't know. The one thing is I never had someone that refused to talk to me after I did a story with them. That's the one. If they're not really happy with it, they're not going to talk to you ever again. So it's a balancing act, but, yeah. As long as we wake up trying to be fair and make sure that we get the full spectrum of what's happening, that was always the approach.
Is there anything at WDEV, at the station, that you've never had a chance to do that you wish Kenley would have let you do?
No, and I have to say I did not really do the trading post. I may have filled in the trading post once, and I think I really – something I didn't – do correctly. It could have been a tire size. It could have been I didn't record the number correctly. So right. I think the one thing that I really they would not let me do is the trading post, which always is kind of like, oh my gosh, I couldn't do the trading post. So I think that's the one, though. And it had something to do with the tire size. I got it wrong. And
but you would have been the perfect person to calm the cows. When I started doing, I thought I was calling them, and a woman had to call in, Anson, and tell me that I was scaring the cows.
Boss. Yeah, you got to calm them down, get them ready to be helped.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, if you're ever up at 6:30 and in the area, we'll sneak you in and let you do another one.
Well, Kaya has some of the all-time great stories of we used to do auction spots, and an auction spot used to be read live. They don't do as many live reads as they used to.
Right.
And they're supposed to be done 30, 60 seconds, whatever. But Kaya has some. They were called starter calves, like starter calves. Mm-hmm. She said the farmer had some startled calves for sale. So that's the classic. Jack Donovan has all the classics about Kaya, so maybe he can share with you when it's his turn to step in.
Yeah, I laugh, but I've probably made similar mistakes on the trading post. It's not an easy gig. All right,
startled calf.
Startled calves, yeah. We got about a minute left. Let's talk birds a little. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. Favorite bird? We once had a contest. What bird would you have a tattoo? If you had to have a tattoo, what bird it would be? I think I'm going with the nuthatch. I'm going with the red-breasted nuthatch. I think it's just it's up, it's down, moves around. It's kind of fierce at times, but friendly and just, buzzing around doing everything. So I think I'll go with a red-breasted nuthatch is my one of my favorite birds.
And the bird that got the whole thing started for the birds?
It was a purple finch. It was a purple finch. In the end, it was a purple finch. People thought it might have been a cardinal. It might have been a redpole. It might have been a house finch, but it was a purple finch.
Oh, how about that? So,
yeah,
the purple finch. We owe it all to the purple finch. How great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Anson Tebbets is Secretary for Vermont's Agency of Agriculture. He's maintained his role as host of For the Birds on WDEV, you know, just in case. Anson, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you for your kindness. It's been great to chat.
All right. You're invited to host the Trading Post anytime you'd like.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News Update, and then we'll be back to meet artist Jenny Bryan. And a reminder that today at noon, we've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At
the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This past Thursday, I had an excellent opportunity to spend some time at Norwich University when we were live at the Sullivan Museum and History Center for the annual Military Writers Symposium. I never let an opportunity like that go to waste, so after the show concluded, I spent time perusing the museum, and I'm really glad I did. There are some amazing history displays and military and school memorabilia there. There's also an art exhibit. It's called Liquid Mind, Abstractions by Jennifer Bryan. It's arresting and wonderful, and I knew as I took in painting after painting, I had to find this artist and get her on the show so you could all meet her and learn about her art. She joins us now. Jenny Bryan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Jenny about her paintings, or if you've seen her works and would care to share your reaction to them, you can give us a call. We're at 802-244-1777. Or toll-free 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Jenny, give us a little background on where you're originally from, where you went to school, what you studied.
Okay. Well, I actually grew up right in Berlin, Vermont. So I went to U32 for my high school years, and I ended up following in my father and my sister's footsteps and ended up going to Norwich for college. My dad was class of 1970. He got his MBA in 2003. And my sister graduated in 1999. But I actually have a long history with the university. My grandfather was a professor of geology at Norwich, and my grandmother was a librarian at the college. And my mother actually worked in cadet records in the commandant's office for many years. So it was a pretty long history of Norwich in the family.
Oh, that's outstanding.
Yeah, and I studied English when I went there, so no art background.
Okay. The great thing, you started at Norwich at just 16, and so you were 20 when you graduated. And even though you come from that great lineage of Norwich students and employees, none of them have had an art exhibit at the college like you. Am I right?
That's true, yeah.
All right. Now, when you're not painting, what is your full-time gig? Where did that English degree lead you?
Well, so originally, I had, right after college, I was working at a publishing company. Mm. I ended up working at Norwich shortly after that in development, and then decided to focus on having a family. So I actually was a stay-at-home mom for 10 years, and once my youngest kiddo went to school, I found myself with this, like, what do I do? What am I doing with my life? I don't feel like, even though motherhood is obviously like this wonderful thing, and it's such a good thing to be able to stay home if you can, I just didn't feel like I necessarily had done what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I got into the mental health field, and I started working at Washington County for Choice Academy, working with kiddos with behavioral and developmental disabilities. In 2018, at the end of 2018, and that was when I first got into the education program. And since starting at Choice, I've been to a couple different schools, but always in a very similar capacity, mm-hmm. really focusing on the supporting of, you know, the behavioral issues that children are faced with, and, you know, due to whether it's poverty trauma or, you know, food insecurity, that kind of work, it's been really compelling to me.
Now, before you started painting, had you done any kind of art, even as a hobby?
Not really. When I was in eighth grade, I'm just thinking it way back. In eighth grade, I took a watercolor course at Norwich.
Of course.
Honestly, it feels like a millennia ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, no real interest in art aside from doodling here and there. But picked it up at the end of 2018 and just kind of ran with it. I, you know, starting with just sketching and drawing, eventually leading to the progression of really not maybe conveying what I wanted to convey with a, you know, a pen and paper and bringing acrylic paint into it and feeling like it was much more, I guess, you know, the conveyance of meaning for me seemed way more coherent, even though it's abstract. It's like, you know, how abstract you can look at something and be like, oh, yeah, okay, I get that.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to bring this up again because mm-hmm. what Jenny said was she started painting in 2018. That was just 3 years ago. And I really want to direct people now to your website. The address is jenniferbryanart.com. Because when I see these paintings, I cannot believe that you've only been painting for 3 years. What was it that prompted you to take up, you know, the brush and start to paint?
Well, for me, in 2018, I separated from my ex-husband, who I'm still very good friends with. He's an amazing person. And I was really, I mean, honestly, very straightforward. I was struggling with some severe depression, mm-hmm. and I didn't necessarily know how to convey those feelings in a healthy way. I was, you know, I had been running all the time. I'd been hiking all the time. I'd been pushing my body to its limit, and really picking up a paintbrush felt more therapeutic to me and cathartic, and it really allowed me that space for my mind to kind of process the things that I was feeling. And I think that's really ultimately why I was so drawn to painting, because, you know, it's different being able to pick up and touch and feel. And, you know, honestly, one of the first paintings I did was finger painting. So to move on from that with a brush, it really... For me, it's this process of getting whatever crises I was going through at the time out in a healthier way than, you know, demanding it from my body.
Any instruction, YouTube videos, you know, what before you put, you know, brush to canvas, mm-hmm. what did you know about painting?
Really, just what I learned about watercolor which isn't helpful because, you know, acrylic is so very different from watercolor. And, you know, I think I had maybe taken one of those paint and sip classes at one point with a couple girlfriends.
Sure.
But, you know, it really just came from, this is awful, but I love Instagram because there are so many amazing artists on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And even watching somebody else paint, maybe not like a, you know, a step-by-step process, but seeing how other people paint, how other people use color, how other people use texture. You know, my poor mother, I had moved out of my ex-husband's house at that point, and I was living with my parents, and I was using like one of her, like her butter knives or something that had like the edges on it because
gotcha.
It was giving all this great texture. And she's like, can you please leave my utensils alone?
Oh, come on, Mom. The art is beautiful. Well, you have this very distinctive style. And before you started painting, did you have an idea, maybe envision that this is what your painting style would be, what it would look like, that this was your signature style?
Not really. I mean, because I threw myself into it, I feel like when I started versus where I am now, it's evolved a lot. I think a lot of it also changes depending on, you know, my current state of mind. I have been diagnosed with manic depression, and so there are periods of time where I don't paint anything, and then there are periods of time where, you know, I think there was probably about 8 months where I was painting maybe every day, every other day, and it really just depends on, you know, the feeling of it. I don't necessarily have anything in mind sometimes when I start a painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've tried to move towards some rhyme to the madness with some of my landscapes. There's still very much, you know, an abstract version of a landscape, but it kind of brings things together a little bit more.
They're stunning.
I do have
yeah.
a few up at the museum. So, yeah. you know, it just shows a little bit of the difference in, you know, styles that I've tried to dabble in.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that 8 month painting spree and all the silverware that your poor mom lost at that point. Right. Jenny, tell us about the exhibit currently at Norwich called Liquid Mind Abstractions by Jennifer Bryan.
So the exhibit itself, I worked with Catherine, who was the curator of the Sullivan Museum, to really pick some pieces that portrayed the importance of self-care, of the importance of having some kind of coping skill, some outlet, because, you know, mental illness is something that's indiscriminate of class, race, gender. You know, it really affects all people, young and old, and especially, you know, I think that's part of the reason that it was so important to be exhibited at the Sullivan Museum, because it is a military college.
Right.
And, you know, we all know that Vietnam War era, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, we have a lot of our soldiers coming back with this stigma around seeking help. And I personally, you know, with my own struggles, it's been hard to seek help. And I think that we are coming around to a point in, thankfully, our age where it is less stigmatized by, you know, public. There's less scrutiny about, you know, reaching out for help. But it's important to have that messaging be so clear that, you know, you can talk about it. It's not something that should be a secret, because it's, like I said, it affects everybody, and there's no avenue sometimes for people to feel like they can reach out. But, you know, if they see something or they hear something, whether, you know, it's whether they see the exhibit or right. they hear the radio show, they know, oh, gosh, I can relate to this. That's yeah. something I can really connect with. And maybe it isn't a bad thing to, you know, seek out the help that they need.
Have you heard from other people who have seen the exhibit? How have they reacted to what
they're seeing? Oh, yeah. I definitely have had a really positive reaction for the most part. You know, a lot of people have said that they've seen it, and that as far as spreading that message and awareness about, you know, self-care and destigmatizing mental health issues. So many people, especially it's been wild how many classmates have reached out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, you know, this huge advocacy for the exhibit to, you know, remain this huge talking piece, because there's not anything else like it there right now.
Right.
It's the first abstract exhibit that the museum and the university has ever had there. So that feels huge to me. You know, it feels like I have this platform to really speak on it in a serious way. And, you know, it ties in with my work that I do, too. You know, I work with kiddos, you know, because even kiddos, the trauma doesn't care. You know, our kiddos are one of the first ones to really experience trauma. And whether it's, you know, working in the Barrie City school system, whether it's poverty or homelessness, and you know, it affects you and it affects your whole life. And, you know, later on, you're going to have to build those skills to deal with that kind of trauma. And trauma-informed care is a huge part of what I do. So
How does painting help you express your states of mind and what you might be going through emotionally?
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of the pieces, maybe those like colorful, bright pieces that are exuberant and it's this very kind of chaos. So there's a lot of chaos in some of my paintings, but you know, it's that.
But clarity.
That internal,
But clarity as well, even in that chaos. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so from that, it's kind of a way to piece things together. And sometimes when I start painting something, it will look entirely different than what it eventually comes out as. And I think that's kind of bringing some order to the madness of like having all of these thoughts and all of these feelings and, you know, letting your mind just kind of be a little open to what you're working on. It's sometimes, you know, a way to kind of quiet out the other stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when I go hiking and I can be really present and it's just, you know, the woods. And when I'm painting, it's like being in the woods. It's that very quiet, calming feeling. And even if there's all of that, oh my goodness, I have so much anxiety, that kind of stuff going on, it can all get quieted out while painting. And definitely I have some darker pieces too. I have a painting called Tristesse that is owned by Patricia Canada. And it is in the museum and it is a blue face. And it's like this just abstract blue face that it is very emotive. And I think that even with the abstract, you can really create that emotive feeling of, you know, relaying that message to people through something is huge to me. And I don't always hit the mark. Sometimes I miss the mark, but, you know, I try.
It's interesting. I'm calling up that painting right now on my phone. Mm-hmm. When I go to an exhibit, I usually take pictures of some of the paintings that speak to me, that really, you know, kind of get kind of a reaction from me. I took a picture of every single painting in your exhibit. I don't know if you get that reaction from people, but I just couldn't bypass a single one without stopping and kind of diving in and trying to get a feeling for it. And the use of the vivid colors were magic to me, the way you paint. I wonder, I don't want to belabor this point. I don't want to embarrass you, but when people find out that you only have been painting for 3 years, are they agog like I am? Are they amazed at how far you've come in such a short amount of time?
I definitely had a lot of BS. There's a lot of BS. There's been a lot of that reaction. Honestly, it's been a really great opportunity. I think my father has been a huge advocate for me, and a huge fan of my artwork. And, you know, he said things like, I just can't believe that you can do this. I can't even imagine being able to do this.
Yeah.
And it's been really meaningful for me to have, you know, to have that reaction from him. And like, you know, when my reception happened, like turning around and seeing that my dad had made it, because he wasn't supposed to be there. He was supposed to be in Maine, and he surprised me. And it was this huge, like, feeling of relief that he was there, because he's just been so vocal about it. And it's, you know, it's nice to be reminded that, you know, oh, my God, I can't believe you've done this. You've come this far, and you've done these things. It's like, it feels weird, honestly, to have an exhibit. Like, it just feels really weird.
Well, it's well-deserved. Jenny Bryan's exhibit is called Liquid Mind, Abstractions by Jennifer Bryan. currently showing at the Sullivan Museum and History Center at Norwich University, but only through November 22nd. So if you want to see it, you got to get there pretty quickly. And you can visit her website. It's jenniferbryanart.com. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us, sharing your art with us this morning. This was great. All right. Take care. That is our show for today of Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, don't forget, tomorrow you can join us. First of all, we've got the Radio Vermont Job Fair at the Capitol Plaza. That goes on 7 to 1. I'll be broadcasting live from the Job Fair from 9 to 11. If you're looking for a job, looking for a change of career, show up tomorrow. We've got at least 20 different employers who are ready to hire. The Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up today at noon, right after Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. Rick Singeri, meet you back here tomorrow. Thanks.